is discrete. It's going to be based on discrete network type structure, based on unitary replacement rules, which includes causality at a fundamental level, and as a creationist might incorrectly say of Darwinian evolution, they could correctly say that this is just the theory, where we should really interpret theory in the particle physics sense of a mathematical model that might or might not have anything to do with reality. I hope it does, but we'll find out. So, why might one be interested in studying a discrete model of space-time? Well, I don't think I need to do a lot of work to persuade this crowd, but just to briefly summarize, it's possible that space-time really is discrete in quantum gravity, in which case our model ought to be two, or if you try to do the continuum path integral, or a continuum canonical quantum gravity, there's issues involving the ill-defined continuum things, and so discretization could regulate that and give you finite answers. So I'm going to start by describing the kinematics of the model, which I mean in roughly the same sense as loop quantum gravity to mean the degrees of freedom at one moment of time, although I'll define everything from the get-go in a spatially diffeomorphism invariant way. So the kinematics, inspired by loop quantum gravity, I'm going to be taking space at one time to be given by a network. I'm going to make it an abstract network, meaning it doesn't actually sit in any sort of geometry, it just defines the geometry, with some valence. So you've got some trivalent vertices here. And I'm going to label it. Each of the vertices is going to be labeled with two arrows, which I'm going to call the future arrow and the past arrow. And that's because once I tell you how the dynamics works, which this is just the kinematics, but when we get to the dynamics, the future arrow will govern the evolution to the future, and the past arrow will govern evolution to the past. So this arrow degree of freedom can point, it lives at the vertex, but it can point along one of the edges. Or the vertex can point to itself. And similarly with the past arrow degrees of freedom, if we make these two arrows independent, then each vertex has a 4×4, it's going to be a 16-dimensional Hilbert space at each vertex. Now, you don't have to make the arrows independent. In fact, you can generalize so that these arrows don't even commute with each other, which might decrease the number of degrees of freedom in the model, but it doesn't make it simpler to explain. So I won't do that. So, now the basis states, we have a vector space of kinematic states, and they're defined, the vector space is defined as linear superpositions of states in this special basis, which I'll call basis states, and there's one basis state for every trivalent network labeled in the way that I told you. So over on the right there, you see an example where each vertex has a past or a future arrow pointing along an edge or to itself. And they can point together or separately. So there's an analog of spatial diffeomorphism invariance, which is that if any of these two graphs are related to each other by a graph isomorphism, which preserves all of the structure that I told you about, then we will regard those two graphs as being equivalent. Now, this vector space has a natural inner product, and here it is. The kinematical inner product between two basis states is just a delta that says whether they're the same as each other times the automorphism group of the network. This is a symmetry factor. Since this is only zero, non-zero when A and B agree, it doesn't matter whether we call this odd A or odd B. So for example, in that graph you see down there at the bottom, there's four symmetries because we can reflect it either horizontally or vertically, so in a way that preserves all the structure. So the inner product of that state with itself would be four. If the network has a boundary, it's important not to count any symmetries which affect the boundary if you are looking at an open network. Now, I want to intuitively motivate why that odd A symmetry factor is necessary. And I'll motivate it with this argument. Without that symmetry factor, this kinematical inner product is not going to be invariant if you apply a local unitary transformation. And this is important because eventually my dynamics will be defined by unitary local replacement rules. So I need for this inner product to respect that structure. So here's my graphical example. Suppose we have this black box here, which you could regard either as a fundamental constituent of some quantum gravity model, or you could regard it as a stand-in for some network of the sort that I told you, which has one outgoing edge. And suppose that I do a sort of unitary transformation where I say that this black box is actually the superposition of red and blue over square root of 2. So that looks like unit normalization on both sides. But if you then connect two of these things together and check how this normalization works, if you do the rule I said, then this, when they're both the same, the inner product is twice as big as you expect. So this is just expanded out using sort of algebra and in sort of binomial way. And if you double the inner product of the ones where both colors are the same, then you get the inner product on both sides is the same. But if you don't, it isn't. And you could think of this as being due to diffeomorphisms that relates red and blue. You'll notice there's only one cross term here because blue-red is the same as red-blue. And that's why you need to put in the symmetry factor to have consistency. Here's another way to think about it, in case one wasn't enough. Another way to think about it is this kinematic inner product comes from a sort of sum over histories in a trivial theory where there's no dynamics and therefore nothing happens. But even if nothing happens, there could still be multiple histories if there's graph isomorphisms, because if that nothing happens, and then we identify the left blue with the right blue, or we could have nothing happens with a twist. And that's equally allowed, so when you add those together, you get two, that symmetry factor. So now I want to talk a little bit about why it's hard to put dynamics in a discrete theory of quantum gravity like this. So in quantum gravity, the dynamics takes the form of reduction to a physical state space. Because time translation in a theory like general relativity are gauge symmetry in a background free theory, when you impose this additional gauge symmetry, you have to dramatically reduce the number of degrees of freedom in theory. So instead of specifying dynamics by saying how the state evolves with time, we specify dynamics by saying how we reduce from a big kinematic vector space to a smaller dynamical vector space. Now there's actually two equivalent ways to do this. One of them is you could impose a constraint. So in this picture here, we have a big vector space, but the physical states are only allowed to lie on this red subvector space. And that's what we talk about when we talk about imposing the Hamiltonian constraint. It says the only physical states are those satisfying the Wheeler-DeWitt equation, h psi equals 0. But there's another way to do it, which is actually equivalent, which is that you can reduce to the physical subspace by modding out states that you call pure gauge states. So in this case, we identify directions which vectors in the space which we regard as being pure gauge vectors, and then we say any two states that differ by one of these pure gauge vectors is the same state for physical purposes. So in that case, the physical states are the gauge equivalency classes, the orbits of the kinematical state vector space. And I say these two pictures are equivalent because you can move from one to the other by simply dualizing the physical and kinematical Hilbert vector spaces. So even though people in canonical quantum gravity, people usually talk about the atomic constraint, I like this picture better, so I'm going to be using it. And the reason I like it better is because every kinematic state is already a physical state even before we solve the dynamics. So I can just give you a kinematic state, like one of those basis states I told you, and that is automatically somewhere on one of this on one of these orbits. So I've just also told you a physical state. However, it might turn out that that state is the zero vector if its orbit passes through zero. So now, what's the problem with dynamics? Well, the ways people usually impose the dynamics in loop quantum gravity, you either try to impose the Hamiltonian constraint in a canonical formulation, or you have a sum over histories covariant formulation, like in spin foam models. But either way, there can be problems with arrests. And some of the problems that can, yes?
I think you've made a choice already at this point of the dynamics, which is to express it ultimately in terms of something like a Wheeler-DeWitt equation. But it's not clear that that's the only way to go, in fact. I mean, I think a path integral formulation doesn't necessarily lead you there. So.
Well,
but anyway, the main question is, do you agree? Is that what, that's what you're doing? You're assuming
that
the...
Well, I partly agree and partly disagree. I agree that if you just do something like a sum over histories, you might not actually end up with something that's equivalent to a Hamiltonian constraint. But I think that if you don't end up with something like that, it would be a bad thing, whereas you probably think it's a good thing. Or an okay thing. But what I'm going to show you does have an analog of that.
This is the so-called frozen formalism.
The so-called frozen formalism, but I believe the frozen formalism is actually okay. Although my formalism is not frozen because because I'm in this other picture. This is sort of a frozen formalism.
Well, you said that, yes. But you claim they're mathematically equivalent.
They are. Yes. Yeah. So I think the frozen formalism.
So basically, there's no time. I mean, you have the problem of time.
Correct. But the problem of time is really a problem of identifying what are the correct observables. And I guess I subscribe to what you might call the orthodox viewpoint it's okay because all true observables should be defined in a sufficiently relational fashion to some form. So other people will doubtless disagree with that. So some of the problems that can arise with dynamics, there's various proposals for dynamics in loop quantum gravity, but they tend to have one of these sets of problems here. One problem that can arise is ultra-locality. So for example, if you take Tiedemann's proposal for the Hamiltonian constraint, then it turns out that Hamiltonian constraint only grows the network locally by adding extra loops where the vertices were, but it doesn't actually propagate any degrees of freedom from vertex to vertex. And so it doesn't seem to have causal properties. So that's one problem that can arise. If you, in other approaches, If you make more complicated dynamics that don't have that problem, then you have to check for consistency in various ways. And the canonical approach, this checking for consistency, involves looking at the commutator as the Hamiltonian constraint with itself, and then this could contain diffeomorphism anomalies if this doesn't end up actually closing. Or in the covariant approach, the analogous problem is that you want to show at the end of the day that any states related by diffeomorphisms are null vectors that have zero inner product with any other state. There's also proposals for dynamics which are not completely background free that, for example, involve just specifying a sort of global Hamiltonian, or in other ways involve picking out uniquely one particular foliation of space. And that's bad because it's not like general relativity where there's this multi-fingered time. Yes?
So the commutator, I think you have an equivalent problem which is that your gauge orbits should be well defined. So the commutator property that this algebra closes ensures you that you can actually take the equivalence classes of your to get the physical states.
Yes.
So you have an equivalent problem and a newer description, whatever that means, and I think it's basically equivalent to what we call the Riggi map, which is basically that you can actually take the equivalence classes.
Right. So there's a question of whether you have the right number
states
when you take this out. And since these are just related by dualizing, you can't solve the problem just by going to the dual picture, but you should still
to make sure that you get the right size of these gauge orbits.
I agree.
But this is what he says when he says that you have to make sure that they are null vectors.
Yeah.
So this is why it's a hard problem.
Yeah.
So I'm going to try to outline my solution later, but now I'm just trying to say that it is a problem. So in my paper, I draw an analogy between this problem and a problem that's actually well known in a completely different field of parallel processing computers in computer programming. And this problem arises. So the physics problem comes from the fact that there's no absolute clock that regulates the speeds of various processes in different places. And the same issue arises when you're doing a parallel programming problem where your computer has multiple processors that are supposed to be solving parts of the problem independently. So you call each of the routines that is being executed on one of these parallel processors, you call it a thread. But when your program breaks the problem up into being calculated on these different threads, you can't just do it any old way because there's consistency conditions that you need to always get the same, to get an answer, a unique answer on. So the first kind of problem that can arise in the computer programming is if what is called a race condition. If you have two processes on your, two sub-programs in your computer that are competing for the same data resource. For example, suppose that thread A includes an instruction that toggles a bit from 0 to 1, well, thread B wants to measure whether it is 0 or 1. Well, that's bad in computing because we want our computation to get a unique answer, and we don't want it to depend on which of our processor units happens to be running faster, since that's irrelevant from the perspective of the algorithm. And it's bad similarly in quantum gravity because time evolution should give an unambiguous answer. It's okay to have probabilities, but you want the probabilities not to depend on which parts of space you happen to evolve first. The second problem is called deadlock. So it's natural to try to solve the first problem by putting in various restrictions, by like locking down certain bits and saying this thread isn't allowed to access this bit until the other program says it's okay, and so on. So if you put in too many restrictions, The other problem you get is deadlock, where processes are waiting for each other to finish, and they get stuck. And then, you know, if A is waiting for B, and B is waiting for C, and C is waiting for A, and they can't do anything until they get these new inputs, then you're not going to get an answer. It's bad in computing because we want an answer. In quantum gravity, we want time not to just come to an end somewhere random in the middle of this room. If there's some processing here, we don't want the calculation to just grind to a halt. Maybe it would be okay at a final singularity, but at least most of the time, in most places, we don't want time to just end. So the universe's computer, so to speak, has to be programmed in a way to avoid these problems. I'm going to propose one way that could be. Yes?
I guess this was just sort of metaphorical, but it sounds a little bit at odds with what you told us before, that there's no time. I mean, now you're talking very much about Hamiltonian is actually doing a time evolution, not just as a constraint.
Well, there is, so this is partly why I said it's not a frozen formalism. There is such a thing as a time evolution in my model that evolves one configuration to another configuration, but this time evolution is a gauge symmetry, so the state you begin with and the state you end with are related by, are the difference between those two states is a pure gauge vector. That's how it works.
It's the race problem. I mean, you know, now you're saying there's the inverse of the frozen time is that you have too many times and you're saying it doesn't matter, right? So the race problem expressed that if you evolve one way or the other, it's the same thing. So that's
right.
The dual of the frozen time. The dual of the frozen time is that there are too many times.
Right, so in a way this is an orthogonal problem. You could have this problem arising even if time was a real dynamical symmetry and not a gauge symmetry, but in the model I'm going to describe, it will end up being a gauge symmetry.
So if it's just a gauge symmetry, it wouldn't matter that much if they don't commute. It seems like it's really the question of how many degrees of freedom you end up with physically in the end.
Well, at the end of the day, I need this model to prove that it does work. Maybe other models could work. But
what if you just make them all identify because they're all gauge?
I guess it depends also a bit on whether you see this model really as a fundamental theory or just as a regularization of the fundamental theory. For example, in vector calculus, you can also evolve a discrete hypersurface forward in time. And if you choose different simplices in different orders, you get different geometries. But this is also because the symmetries are broken. So this is because it's a regularization of a continuum theory. But in the continuum, the symmetries are preserved. And then it doesn't really matter in which order you do it. But for example, in the vector calculus, when you have flat geometries, then the symmetries are preserved. And then also the ordering of it doesn't matter. So
in the strict continuum limit, yeah.
Well, no, I mean, for example, in three dimensions, in the vector calculus, without a cosmological constant, the geometries are all flat. And then in that case, for example, so this is equivalent to the continuum solution then, but in that case, for example, it also doesn't matter whether you
Right, well, in certain theories that are topological or otherwise very simple, you could just...
No, but for example, in four-dimensional theory, the reason that it's that you get different solutions in the vector calculus is because the symmetries are broken. So the different solutions you get from the initial data surface are distinct because the symmetries are broken, but if you went to some continuum limit, then...
Right, so let's pretend this is a fundamental model of nature,
yeah, sure,
and we aren't
going
to take the continuum limit in that sense. Yeah.
So can this be compared to the, if I do that in the continuum and take lapse, for instance, and shift as additional variables? You know, then lapse and shift would also tell me how to time evolve a hypersurface. And in principle, I don't need to care about commutative of Hamiltonian. And so what... Are you adding lapse and shift as dynamic variables?
There will be there's a discrete analog of the lapse and shift vector.
And they are dynamic variables, basically?
Which I'll tell you that.
But the race problem is the expression that it doesn't depend on the lapse and shift.
No, but I think he's going to have them as dynamic variables. So then.
Well, why don't you wait till I have the dynamics, and then you can tell me about it. So here's my solution, and it's in terms of those errors I described. So my rule is, so what I want to do is I want to identify in one of these network states at one time. I'm going to identify some initial evolution regions, or outers for short, and I'm going to replace those regions with final evolution regions, or FERS for short, that have the same number of external edges so that you can do a network substitution. So in order to define this, I first need to tell you what counts as an initial evolution region that is going to be replaced with another state. So the initial evolution region is going to be defined as a minimal set of vertices whose future arrows all point to each other. So here's an example. If you have a vertex that points to itself, then that vertex is an IR all by itself. If you have two vertices that point to each other, then the two vertices together can evolve jointly, and that's an IR. And if the future arrows are all pointing around in a loop, then you might worry that this would be a deadlock if you applied this rule, because this one's waiting for this and that's waiting for this. But to get around that problem, I'm going to define the whole loop as being an initial evolution region, no matter how large it may be. So this is the simplest rule that I can think of that avoids deadlock and race conditions. It avoids deadlock because you can show in any closed network there's at least one I. And you can prove that just by starting on any one vertex, moving along the arrows, such that if the network is finite, eventually you must come back to a vertex you've already seen, and then that defines one of these regions. It also avoids race conditions because no two of these IRs can overlap with each other, so it doesn't matter which one comes first. You can prove that by saying if two IRs overlap with each other, you would end up needing to have a vertex that points to two different edges, which is not allowed. And the exact, yes.
I'm confused about if I have two loops.
Yes.
So what's the rule of putting this edge in this?
So if you have two loops,
is the beginning.
So, suppose you try to have two of these things on top of each other, where this goes around like this, and this goes around like this. Well, this is bad because it has two arrows.
So what is the minimal rule in the beginning? You should not have, I was not there in the first instance. What is the rule of, you should not have.
Right, so the rule is each of the, every vertex, there is one and only one arrow, one and only one future arrow, which points either along one of the, if it's a trivalent vertex, it points either along one of the three edges, or it points to itself, like that, the vertex itself. And then there's also a past arrow, which is an independent degree of freedom, and the past arrow, you use the same rule in terms of the past arrow to define the future evolution regions that can be evolved backwards.
You're just saying, basically, this network fibers into circles or loops or something like that, according to this. You just start anywhere and you get a loop.
Yes.
Or it might reach a boundary, I suppose.
You can start anywhere and get a loop, but that loop might not include the place you started.
Well,
because it could go like this.
Yeah.
And then this would have to wait for some evolution to occur before anything could happen. Yeah.
So one question about the race problem, which is in here. Seems to me here what you're saying is that you're avoiding the race problem. So there's never any races.
That's right. That's how. Yeah.
But that's a bit different than, so, which is more like if I pick up a particular foliation, I never have any race. But that's a bit different than solving the race problem.
Well, it depends on what you mean by solving. This is a solution to the race condition in the sense that the race condition never pops up to bother me and make the model inconsistent. If you believe on physical grounds that there ought to be races between different regions and somehow it must be resolved, then maybe you would be.
But in what sense, so it's more an avoidance of the race problem, which I can do, let's say, by saying, I mean, a continuum analog, which will I will have in the continuum to say, well, let me define time to be proportional to the extrinsic curvature or inverse extrinsic curvature, something locally, so that there's only one way to evolve. So in that case, there would be no races.
So that's what, it seems you add laps as a dynamical variable or gauge fix.
So there's the model is multi-fingered in the sense that there is the laps can be a function of position in the sense that you can have multiple evolution regions, initial evolution regions, which are space-like separated, and in that case it doesn't matter which one you evolve first. So at any given moment of time, time has a number of possible different fingers, but they're all spatially disjoint. Whether that's good enough? Well, it's good enough to make a consistent model, anyway. After that, it's all what else are you demanding?
Yeah. And this could be very big, I guess. That would be the worry.
Right.
So whatever they are called.
These loops sort of introduce, in a sense, a non-local feature, and that this could be arbitrarily big. So you can imagine some configuration where like the whole giant universe was just in one loop and everything was non-locally stuck. On the other hand, you could also imagine a configuration where all of the loops are very small at Poincaré distances, and then you'd expect roughly local behavior. So it all depends on how the dynamics actually go. So here's another way of looking at this same issue of no overlapping regions to avoid the race condition. This is a sort of space-time geometry picture, which is in a classical theory like general relativity, of course, nothing prevents you from having time evolution to the future over here on the left in a way that overlaps with time evolution over here on the right. So there's nothing inconsistent about that, but geometrically, we expect that if there is an overlapping space-time regions, then there'll be an intersection region right here. And you could choose to think about this process as first you evolve forwards on the intersection, and then you evolve forwards from there on the left and the right in independent ways. So that's consistent as a continuum model, but if we want to have a discrete model where there's a fundamental unit, discrete time evolution, then by definition, if this is a discrete time evolution that's indivisible, and this is a discrete time evolution that's indivisible, then by definition, they can't have any non-trivial intersection. And that's another way to argue that these regions should not overlap. The same argument would apply to show that there cannot be overlapping final evolution regions, but there's nothing wrong with an ire and a fur overlapping with each other, because as you can see from the space-time diagram here, there's no conflict. So now I'll tell you how this dynamics actually works. Now this is a quantum theory, so we can't just have a classical replacement rule. We need to have a quantum mechanical transitions. So the rule is based on describing the unitary transition amplitudes that turn ires into furs. So in order to make this well defined, we have to first sort the ires and furs into classes based on the total number of external edges, because obviously local evolution can't change the number of edges on the boundary. Then for each class Q, where we've identified the total number of external edges, like for example, 4, if it's this ire, then for each class, we can identify a unitary operator, which I'll call I, which maps you from the vector space of Iers to the vector space of Furs. Now, when I say unitary, I mean that I is a unitary matrix with respect to the kinematic inner product of the Iers and Furs. Now, you remember when I defined the inner kinematic inner product, there was a factor of the automorphism group. So it's unitary up to the necessary symmetry factors there. And the second thing we need, besides unitarity, is that I has to be symmetric with respect to permuting the boundary edges. Because if there's four external edges, then the whatever the dynamics are, if they don't make any reference to anything outside, then they can't discriminate between those edges. So it would need to preserve the representation of the permutation group of four elements in that case. So subject to those two constraints, you can pick this unitary matrix to be basically whatever you want, and the elements of the matrices are going to be the constants of nature associated with this model. So it's the free parameters. Now, because there is no absolute time, I implements a gauge symmetry. You can think of I for identical. If you start with a network A, and you act on it with I and get a superposition of different networks B, then A and that and B are going to be identified as being the same physical state. So their difference will not outweigh the difference. So here's an example to make this more concrete. Suppose we start with a bivalent duct. That means that we're sort of like we're in 1+1 dimensions. And each of the vertices has two edges coming out of it. So there's 12 possible initial evolution regions, because you could have one of these states where the future, where its future arrow points to the vertex itself, and then there's three possible ways for the past arrow to be. And you could have a pair that points to each other, and then each of these vertices has three ways for the past arrow to be, which is kind of just like initial data, the coloring data for these purposes. So that's 9, so 3+9 is 12. So there's 12 states of the initial evolution regions, which have two external edges. And of course, there also have to be 12 first, by the same argument. So what we end up specifying is a 12 by 12 dimensional unitary matrix, which is symmetric under reflecting left and right. Then we have to deal with the evolution regions to have zero external edges, which is the only other possibility because it's bivalent vertices. You can have big loops where the sort of entire connected component of the universe is as the arrow is wrapping around. Since there's infinitely many states like this, you would need infinitely many parameters in your unitary evolution. So that seems a bit frightful, but you can impose an ansatz to bring it down to a finite number of parameters. For example, we could demand that the evolution rule acts independent, that this evolution rule, not this one, but this loop one, acts independently on each vertex, for example, and doesn't actually change the network. Now, the trivalent duct is the same way, only a bit more complicated. So you could have, if you restrict to patch their moves, for example, then the allowed evolutions involve there's four states like that, 64 like that, or like that. So we have a big old matrix to the corresponding time reverse states. And if we include allowed patch their moves to relate these, then we have this set of states here that evolves the corresponding states, and these moves can change the structure of the network. Well, we also have loops. Now the loops have external edges. Once again, we could have a unitary, a different unitary matrix for each value of the number n being the number of external edges. But if we assume that this rule only acts locally at each vertex, we end up again with a finite but somewhat large number of parameters. You can lower the number of parameters by making the past and future arrows not commute, but that's just a bit harder to describe, but it can bring you the single-digit numbers of parameters. Okay, now I'm going to tell you about the sum over histories. So I need to define what I mean by a history. So a history is, the basic idea is that a history is just any sequence of transitions that takes you from a basis state A to a basis state B, where you either, in each step, you either replace an initial evolution region with a final evolution region, you have to replace an R with a fur, or you replace a fur with an R to have backwards evolution. Now, there's some fine print here. The fine print is that these histories are related by diffeomorphisms, so some of these histories are actually the same as each other. So shift diffeomorphism, so the discrete analog of that, is that any two histories that differ by a graph isomorphism of an intermediate state need to be regarded as equivalent histories, as long as it preserves all the structure and the initial and final states are unaffected. If the initial and final states are affected, then we need to count them as different in order to get those symmetry factors I told you about. Similarly, with lapsed diffeomorphisms, if you have something occurring in one region and something occurring in the other region, it doesn't matter which one happens first. And so therefore, you count them happening in either order as being the same history. And finally, there's a rule that says no backtracking, which says it's not possible to evolve forwards and backwards in the same spatial location. And I'll explain the reason for that in just a bit. So about these lapsed diffeomorphisms, this is the way you implement multi-fingered time. I already talked about this a little bit in response to the questions, but you imagine you have some sort of network here, and you have the possibility to replace this graph with this graph, or you have the possibility to replace this graph with this graph, then you could do it in either order. And if we started here, and we ended here, these two histories are actually the same history. So this is necessary in order to avoid having absolute time where there's a clock, where everything is a clock governing time everywhere. It's analogous to the lapsed diffeomorphisms in general relativity. Now, about forwards and backwards evolution, you probably noticed I said that you also need to include the possibility of backwards in time evolution in this history. So you do that using the inverse of this I matrix. And why do we include backwards evolution? Well, there's this paper by Thielboin that's called Causality versus Gauge Invariance. And it he showed that in a continuum theory, that of GR, that if you quantum mechanically, if you don't include these backwards in time transition amplitudes, then you don't end up with a gauge invariant final result. He seemed to think that that backwards in time would somehow be incompatible with causality. I don't agree, but this is the reason why you need to include backwards in time. A more conceptual reason is you could say, suppose that the state A evolves forwards in time to another slice B, and suppose we interpret this as a gauge symmetry, saying that A and B are actually the same state. Well then, if clearly saying that two things are the same state is a symmetric relation. So if A is the same state as B, it must also be true that B is the same state as A. So if we start with B, we need to include that it's equivalent to A. So you can't not include these backwards evolutions. In fact, you can even combine them, but you have to combine them in the right way. what is allowed is to have a sort of straddling history. In fact, by allowed, I mean necessary for consistency. You must have these straddling histories where part of the space-time evolves forwards in time, and part of it evolves backwards in time. This is just, in this figure, you could say, if all of these really are the same state, then clearly this must be the same state as that, too, and you get that by evolving backwards in one place and forwards in the other place. But what's not allowed is what I call backtracking, where you evolve forwards, and then you evolve backwards in the same spatial region. If you did allow that, then even a single step of time evolution, you could just bounce back and forth forever, and you get an infinite divergence. Conceptually, the way I think about this is that these are sort of redundant histories. That if you wanted to evolve forwards to B and then backwards to A prime, you should regard that set of histories as sort of already included in the transition amplitude that goes directly from A to A prime. And there are Feynman rules. Now, I've made a lot of assertions in this talk, and you may wonder how I derived them all. And this is the answer. Trial and error. These Feynman rules I constructed because if you do anything different from what I'm about to tell you, the proofs of the consistency of gauge invariance in the next slide after this don't work out. So the histories involve a product over transitions. The transitions are just what takes you from one time step to the next time step, so t is the number forwards or backwards changes. So t is just is basically just given by this I matrix, or if you're evolving backwards in time, by the inverse of the I matrix, although there's some symmetry factors that come in, and that's because I is not a symmetric matrix when you have these symmetry factors, but you need t to be. There's also a factor of 1 over the automorphism group of the entire space-time history, if there's any automorphism that don't affect its boundary. This is actually analogous to a similar factor that appears in regular Feynman diagrams in quantum field theory. And then, of course, you sum over all possible histories that begin in A and end at B. And what you've done there is you've defined the physical inner product between state A and state B. So that's my definition of the inner product. And now, what properties does it have? So here's some nice stuff. First of all, it's Hermitian, as an inner product should be. And the reason why it's Hermitian is just that if you evolve from A to B forwards, and then you have the corresponding backwards evolution history, that's just given by the complex conjugate. So because the time reverse of any history is just the complex conjugate of the forwards history. The second property it has is this gauge degeneracy property that I kept harping on earlier in the talk, which says that if I is a particular ire connected to some complementary region, and if you replace it with A using this identity matrix, summing over the possible final values for it to be, so this is a superposition. So if you evolve the state forwards in time, and then you subtract the result from the initial state. This is the difference between those two states, which I said is a gauge vector. That vector should have zero inner product with any other state to justify it being called a gauge vector. And this property can be proven from the Feynman rules that I gave you. If you change anything, it isn't true. And to the best of my knowledge, it's unknown whether a similar expression holds in the spin foam version of loop quantum gravity. So in that sense, I want to say this is, in my formalism, the analog of there being no diffeomorphism anomaly. A third property you might like is positivity. Yes.
So is the Feynman rules you've given, are they a new physical input, or are they a clever way of just producing something that was already implicit in what you had before? You have sort of equivalence classes, and you have what you call the kinematic inner product. And does that, in fact, imply your physical inner products?
I don't
by
think
taking
so.
Quotient or something.
I don't
like
think
that.
So, because just saying which vectors you mod out doesn't tell you what is the inner product of the remaining physical state space of non-zero inner vectors. There's various tricks people use. I mean, in loop quantum gravity, people do things like group averaging to try to get a physical inner product. You can think of this as playing the same role, but I should emphasize it's not group averaging, it's something different.
But in finite dimensions, I presume there wouldn't be an inner. Is it just because you're in infinite dimensional Hilbert space that you can't just mod out and get an inner product from that?
In a finite dimensional Hilbert space, you could just mod out and get an inner product, but I don't think it wouldn't be the right inner product, I think. It would not respect the causality relations of the model. I might have to poke through a simple toy example to have a better opinion about that. But this is basically defining the inner product through all possible dynamical histories. So it's doing your identification of states for you, like in the, which is what the spin phone people try to do as well. So you also probably want your inner product to be positive. So the good news is that I can prove this for situations in which each state has a finite past, which admittedly is only possible by slightly modifying the terms of my model, since the no deadlock thing means you can always evolve infinitely the past or the future. But if you allow for some small amplitude for things to get deadlocked, you find that this inner product is always positive, because you can just evolve every state back in time to the initial, earliest possible time configuration, and then the physical inner product was just the kinematic inner product, which is positive. Now, I believe this should also hold for the full theory where the states do not have a finite past, but for various technical reasons, I can't prove it. So I could be wrong. I don't have any good examples of things where I think there would be a negative state, but that's one hole to plug, but I think it's going to be positive. Assuming it is, and assuming that the inner product converges here, this gives you exactly the things you need in order to actually say that the physical states are Hilbert space.
So about
yes.
Convergence, you didn't mention that, but is the sum finite, or do you know? Like the
so what I know about the sum is that it diverges no faster than exponentially, which is actually good. It's a lot better than, for example, non-causal dynamical triangulations, where you can prove that it goes faster than any exponential due to having lots of wormholes. But there is a convergence issue. Oh, yes. There is a convergence issue. I suspect... since the sum over histories is Lorentzian, there can be histories that have large absolute amplitudes whose phase cancel to zero. And as you may know, it's a mathematical fact that a series is absolutely convergent if and only if the absolute values of all the terms go to zero, are finite, if they converge. So as I said, you can show that at the worst, the number of histories diverges exponentially. So that suggests that if this inner product does not converge, and there are simple toy examples I know of where it does not converge, it can still be able resummed, possibly. So if you add a damping factor to this inner product, so that's just an extra multiplying factor for every time step here, then for sufficiently small values of C, because of this fact here, this is guaranteed to converge to an analytic function of C. At that point, assuming there's no obstructions, you can analytically continue to C equals 1, and you get something that basically has these same properties. Up to the one of the properties I proved. If I didn't prove positivity, hopefully it wouldn't mess up that.
I guess that's, yeah, maybe that's the, I mean, you know, no Lorentz amplitude ever converges anyway. So, but that's where usually you have, when you do the, this is maybe where there's sometimes, you know, anomalies appear when you have,
right.
You know, you always have to have a high epsilon prescription or whatever it is to define it.
Right.
And
so
you have
to
be careful.
I suspect it will not converge and that it can, you can nevertheless get a.
Yeah, yeah, you don't have it to. I mean, Lorentz and amplitude don't converge, so that's, you know, that's okay.
That's
not true.
Well, anyway.
Well, it's that as I.
And quantum mechanics, for example.
Quantum mechanics, if you decorotate them, right, you know
so,
they look like, you know, they're not absolutely convergent, they're convergent, but not absolutely convergent.
So now that I've defined this model and talked about its consistency properties, I'll just say a little bit about the actual physics you could get with this.
So your expectation is that it won't converge, but it might be resummable somehow?
Yes.
So suppose you had proof positivity, isn't there an issue then the analytic continuation is not
potentially
guaranteed?
Yeah, depending on the nature of the proof, but that could arise.
Because you don't, you know, Osterwald, the Schrader, all this stuff. So
right, I mean,
I can't
obviously speak with any definiteness before I know what this unknown proof of positivity would look like. But yes, that's something to worry about. So it turns out there's an analog of null surfaces in this model. The histories are defined, do have an inherent causal structure. In fact, you can think of the space-time histories as being a causal set plus more. So this analog of a null surface is, suppose you have a region in which all of these arrows sort of line up. So everything is waiting, and it can't evolve anymore until whatever is behind this red dashed line gets its act together and sends some arrows pointing back this way. So without the help of this region, you can't evolve this region any further to the future. Well, this is analogous to, in continuous geometry, a null surface. Because a null surface cannot be, while remaining achronal, it cannot be evolved any more forward than time without the help of an additional region which is not null. And then if, with the help of that region, you could push it forward a bit. So these blue lines sort of form an interesting analog to the null surface or horizon generators. So it's possible that in this model you could actually ask questions about horizon thermodynamics, like does the entropy always increase? One caveat, I have no reason at this time to believe that it does increase, but you could at least ask the question. Another thing you could do is try to start the universe from a small seed and grow it out to be really big. So there is no analog of the Hubble-Hawking state because none of my processes change the number of connected components of space. So you can't start getting a universe from nothing, but you could start with a really small seed and evolve that forwards and backwards in time, and then you would entropic arguments would suggest you would end up with some large universe before and after. Now, I put those in scare quotes because of the problem of time. You really need to define everything in a gauge invariant way. So I defined the Hilbert space of gauge invariant observables. An observable you could measure might be something like, what is the probability that the universe will ever be in some particular state described by some particular network. Yeah.
Is there any reason you can't include an empty universe? It seems like you could just sort of put it in my hand and have it evolve to one of these, to any one of these graphs that have no external edges, or these, what do you call them, initial evolution rates.
Well, the reason there can't be a changed number of connected components in general is that if you could do so, then, so if, for example, you have something branching out, then if you went backwards in time, this would be non-local. It would necessarily be, since these two things are not connected to each other, there's nothing to say whether A should evolve with B or some B prime. Now, if you just start with something coming out of nothing, as you suggested, now all I would worry is that it could happen more than once and there'd be something about statistics which is bad. It might not technically satisfy the properties that I want. But whether you can make it work or not.
Yeah, you have to worry that in any sort of simplified evolution, there's sort of an infinite number of bubbles being created that were totally disconnected and not.
Right.
So you have to worry kind of about those.
Right. But in any case, it would be a total sui generis rule that would only activate once in any given universe. It's not clear what would be the difference between, you know, having that rule as a law of physics and just having that as an initial condition. Other than the fact that then you get a past history, I guess. That's it. Okay, so to summarize, if we assume that the issues of convergence and positivity work out okay, as I have only partial arguments for, then this is a fully consistent background-free quantum theory with local degrees of freedom propagating causally. And the thing I put in quotes there is John Baez's definition of a quantum gravity model. And I already mentioned you can generalize the models where the past and future eras can't be simultaneously measured. You just have them be different bases, incompatible bases in some Hilbert space, and that does reduce the number of free parameters. However, the potential or probable bad news, it's not clear whether Lorentz symmetry can emerge from models of this kind. In fact, there are general arguments suggesting, maybe not strictly proving, but suggesting that any discrete model of this kind cannot have a Lorentz symmetric physics. That's from a theorem proven by causal set people that says that there's no way to embed a finite valency graph in a Minkowski space without picking out a particular frame. So perhaps if there is a continuum limit, it would actually be some sort of Einstein ether theory where there's a dynamical preferred frame at every point. That's if there's a continuum limit. Of course, I don't know that either. As you have a large number of a large volume region, it's not at all clear whether an approximate semi-classical space-time emerges or not. This is, of course, a very hard problem. It's probably related to the existence of a stable vacuum state. So, mainly I focused on the microscopic problems of what makes consistent microscopic dynamics here. Obviously, this is another huge important thing, but if it's going to be the physics of our world, it has to actually connect on to our non-continuum physics. I'm not saying I have any brilliant ideas right now for solving that. So, what might be done in the future? Well, it might be nice to have some computer simulations to ask questions about convergence and positivity and the continuum limit, but there's a hitch. The simulations probably have to be really small because of the Lorentzian signature. The models are defined inherently in Lorentzian signature, which means there's phases. If you don't make these matrices unitary, things break. And so you can't use the Monte Carlo algorithm, because the number of histories goes exponentially. Maybe you could find some way to wave rotate if you don't care about breaking certain properties of the model, which may or may not be illuminating. To get some insight, one could just try simulating the classical analog of this model, where instead of having unitary transitions, you just have some deterministic evolution. Another interesting idea is you could couple the system to a fixed boundary, maybe, to test some holographic ideas. There's no holographic principle inherently built in here. Everything is sort of based on these local degrees of freedom. But it is subject to diffeomorphism invariants, and no diffeomorphism invariant theory can be truly local in its observables. In fact, there's an argument by Don Morrow back at UC Santa Barbara who suggests that any diffeomorphism invariant theory will have a holographic property, and that's just because the Hamiltonian of a gravitational theory is measurable at the boundary, so it generates a unitary time evolutions on boundary. So if you could couple the system to a boundary, it might be really interesting to test whether this sort of holographic thing emerged or not. So in conclusion, although I wouldn't be surprised if this duct is still missing some important physical ingredients, I'm hoping that at the very least, by solving some of the problems of quantum gravity, it may help diagnose what other things are needed in order to have a good model.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
I think it's very nice. There's something about I want to say about your last question, which is that, you know, as you were saying in the slide before your last one, you're satisfied by the definition, and that's already not a small feat. So that's very important. But aren't you a bit too successful in doing that? That is, you can do that for any specification of these matrices I.
Right. So you'd really for it only to be consistent when you choose the matrices that have some special magical form related to symmetries, and if you're doing spin networks, something related to the 6J or 10J symbols or whatnot. So that it would be lovely if the model sort of was, in a sense, finicky enough to constrain things. And it looks like it isn't. And I agree that that is, in a way, disturbing. In continuum quantum field theory, a lot of the finickiness of that comes from a normalization group theory, where it turns out there's only a finite number of parameters that are relevant or marginal, and so they're normalizable, so that we're sort of used to having sufficiently strong principles to put us in an effectively finite dimensional space of parameters, which is very good for predictivity. Now, once you go to a discrete model, it's not clear we'll have principles that go down to a finite number of parameters. You could always hope that one of the problems, like Lorentz symmetry or the consistency of the or no diffeomorphism anomalies, you could always hope that one of these problems is sufficiently hard to solve that it actually significantly constrains the form of the theory. But I agree, this isn't that. Yeah.
Can you add some more symmetries to reduce the number of parameters that you have, like time reversal or parity?
Yes.
And that kind of thing?
Actually, my paper I described that you can reduce things using time reversal and parity, and nothing also stops you from adding extra fields on this thing and giving them symmetries. But even with those, it's very hard to get a model that only has, one or two parameters. It's the smallest models I found have something like 5 or 7 or something. And that might just be for the single, there are some ones with single digits, I think, for that.
Thank you.
it does help if you impose these extra symmetries. And actually, one particular symmetry that's missing here is CPT. Of course, there's no Lorentz symmetry, obviously, here either. But we'd sort of like physics to be CPT.
So can you remodel basically what you call the vase model, the vase problem? In the
sorry,
sense,
can you speak louder?
So can you basically get back to the vase problem in the sense that imagine that you have two configurations,
mm-hmm.
and these two, we have also the arrows which basically tell you how to evolve things.
Mm-hmm.
So you can basically imagine that you have two configurations which describe you the same geometry in some sense, but you have different arrow configurations, which would basically simulate that you evolve things in a different order,
mm-hmm.
and you could compare these two, evolution steps in the end. And the closure of the algebra usually means that these different ways to evolve something to the same state should not matter.
Well, that's manifestly true in this model, so I don't even see the point of simulating it because it's just
But you comment that basically perhaps the continuum limit is an ESA theory.
Oh.
It means that it's not gravity. So basically it might be that you might get want to have at least, in the macroscopic limit, you might want to get GR back where this property holds.
Well, the property in a sense holds in an ether model too. The kind of model I'm thinking of when I say ether theory is like Ted Jacobson's models where you still have diffeomorphism invariance, but at every point you have a unit time-like vector.
Yeah, so that's what I mean. You have an additional variable.
Yeah.
Similar to your arrows, you have an additional variable which tells you how to evolve the state. You might be fine with having this as an additional variable, but even Ted Jacobson has this certain restriction on the dynamics to get GR back in the macroscopic limit.
It's not clear whether you can get GR back actually from an ether theory.
He has restrictions on the parameters to be consistent
to be consistent with tests.
With GR.
That doesn't mean that the theory reduces the GR.
No, the theory, but to be consistent. So. I'm just saying that it might be to get something back on macroscopic levels which looks similar to GR or maybe even ESA in with parameters which make it consistent with observations. You might try to think about these additional conditions in some approximate sense.
Yeah.
It's because the constraint algebra is there classically. Or at least also, I don't know in which, it's not there in ESA theory, but the theory is in some sense near to GR in this, that you don't see big differences in evolving states in
right.
order. So, you say at some point you don't have different anomalies because you define orbits. But the main question in the end would be how big are these orbits of gauge equivalent states? You can imagine if you would have also this condition, if you would allow much more time evolutions, which you do, if you can evolve overlapping regions in an arbitrary way, you would just have bigger orbits.
Well, I'm pretty sure that the, at least in some cases, the orbits are the right size.
Mm-hmm.
There can be a problem that comes if, for example, you've made the rule so that the number of vertices never changes, so you're just exploring a finite number of states, then you could end up where every state sort of evolves to itself times a phase, and generically that phase will never be one, and so there's no allowed states. I think that's in a sense right, that any theory with a Hamiltonian constraint needs at least one parameter that's sort of unbounded in order to have any states. And it can't just be exploring a compact region of space. But I think if you have a universe that like growth exponentially, I think you have the right number of states in a sense. Because you'd only really need I don't see, in most contexts, I don't see any reason to have zero inner product states besides the ones connected with evolution. Yeah.
I have two questions, which I hope are related to each other. The first one is, you mentioned this could be viewed as a causal set with something extra.
Yes.
Is there a simple statement of what, or a comprehensible statement of what is the extra information that has to be added?
Yes.
And then the second question is how do we see where something like a metric would come out of this? Like in the spin foams or the spin networks or something, there's some fairly definite rules of how to
deduce
a metric under coarse graining, for example, or some singular metric. What is the analog of that?
So as you know, if you have a causal set structure, there's a way to define a metric from that.
That's
so
what
you
I hope
can always define the metric that way. Since there's extra structure, it could of course be that the real metric is related to that one by some field redefinition. The other structure would presumably give you extra fields if you could see it and make an independent limit. But it would at least be a metric, and what's more, it would be the metric which was related to the causal structure. To say what this extra structure is, it's not too hard. The histories, since the states at one time look like networks, the histories look like foams, only they aren't spin foams because their labels are these arrows instead of the spins. But other than that difference, it looks like a spin foam, and then the causal structure is just relating the vertices of this foam. That's the causal set part.
Okay, are there further questions? Well, if not, I believe Philip is continuing our tradition of cake, so let's thank our speaker again, and you're welcome to join us.